We know that wildlife crossings are a good thing. The problem arises when you ask the question, okay, what does that mean for the larger animal population, right? If the goal of a wildlife crossing is to, preserve a population of bears or elk or bobcats or what have you, that's something we know a little bit less about. And I mean, kind of the one of the things that you see in some of these early road ecology studies is not all animals are using these crossings equally.
This is Science for the People. I'm Carolyn Wilkie. Today my guest is journalist Ben Goldfarb. He's the author of the book Crossings: How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. And I'm excited to bring you this conversation about pervasive infrastructure that might, on the surface, seem pretty uninteresting. As Ben notes in his book, some scholars call humans an infrastructure species, and boy, have we built a lot of roads. Crossings focuses on road ecology, a discipline that's exploring all the ways that roads intersect with ecosystems and how roads impact the animals living there. And his book covers a lot of ground, from the history of roads themselves to how this field got going, to what scientists have learned about animals knocked off by cars, migration stymied, and environments riddled with noise pollution. We talk about all that and get into what people have done to try to address the problems caused by roads, including wildlife crossings and campaigns to help move animals that find themselves stuck. Ben relates stories of these efforts from his reporting, including from his visit to Tasmania, the roadkill capital of the world, to witness people caring for car-stricken animals at great cost to themselves. And he shares about what roads reveal about humans and our societies. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thanks so much for joining me today, Ben, to talk about your book, Crossings.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So what prompted you to write this book about the ecology of roads?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as a journalist, I write a lot about wildlife conservation and ecology. And, back in 2013, I sort of wrote this series of stories about habitat connectivity, the idea that animals need to move across large landscapes to find food and mates and all the other things they need to make a living. And obviously roads are, one of the primary obstacles to that kind of free mobility for wild animals. So that year in 2013, I was in Montana, working on these stories, and I actually got a tour of some wildlife crossing structures, these bridges and tunnels on Highway 93 north of Missoula, Montana. And it was just standing on one of those wildlife overpasses, this incredible, spectacular bridge that was really built with grizzly bears and elk and other species in mind. That was just such a compelling idea, the idea that we would create infrastructure for wild animals. And it was just a kind of an amazing intellectual challenge too, or at least that's how it seemed to me. How do you know what kind of bridge a bear or an elk or a moose will want to use? And how do you design infrastructure for non-human users? It seemed both like kind of a beautiful poetic idea that we would accommodate animals in that way, and also just a fascinating scientific and intellectual challenge.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. Somewhere in your book, you call or you refer to someone else calling humans the infrastructure species. So that does strike me as kind of a curiosity that we've started building it for animals.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember being up on this wildlife overpass with Marcel Hauser, who's a great road ecologist, and he was talking about how, the overpass really needed a visual screen because, headlights from cars below would sweep over the overpass. And he had actually, in one of his kind of remote motion activated camera videos, he'd seen a black bear running away from this kind of sweep of headlights. And that's the sort of thing that just captivated me. The headlights, again, we're all so accustomed to being on roads and experiencing all of the sensory stressors that come with traffic. But, for this bear, obviously headlights were this bizarre alien thing. They're not infrastructure species, as you say. So how do you create infrastructure that entices a non-infrastructure species? What an interesting idea.
Yeah. And so to get at that question, You explore the ways that roads affect the landscapes around them, the animals that are living there. Do you mind sharing some of those ways? Obviously, animals becoming roadkill is a big one, but what are other ways that roads hurt and sometimes help creatures?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I mean, certainly roadkill, as you say, is the most conspicuous, obvious one. You know, we've all seen the dead deer or squirrel or raccoon by the side of the highway, you know, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. And even worse in some ways, you know, is the barrier effect that roads create, right? I mean, this steady stream of cars, you know, that goes down, you know, most American highways is incredibly intimidating to wild animals and, you know, often prevents them from crossing altogether. And in some cases that can really be worse than roadkill. You know, in the book, I talk about these big herds of migratory mule deer and elk and pronghorn antelope that live in places like Wyoming, you know, and have to move across really large landscapes seasonally to, you know, find the resources they need. And, you know, in some cases, you know, some of those herds have starved en masse because, you know, highways like Interstate 80 prevent them from reaching these, you know, gentle kind of temperate, low elevation valleys that they need to access in winter to survive. So, you know, as some biologists kind of pointed out to me, you know, I mean, those herds, they can survive, you know, a few collisions, but they can't survive losing access to all of that habitat. So that barrier effect, you know, in some ways is even worse than roadkill itself.
Yeah. And it sounds like there are plenty of other ways that roads are affecting animals, from the salt that runs off of them to, carving up habitats and
absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the big ones that you know, I always think about just because it affects humans so egregiously too is noise pollution. You know, I mean, there are some fantastic studies demonstrating that, you know, noise pollution is really a form of habitat loss, right? I mean, if you're an animal, you know, you really make your living with your ears in a lot of ways. You know, if you're an owl, you have to listen to the rustling footsteps of your prey in the grass. And if you're a vole, you know, you have to listen to the footsteps of a coyote or the wing beats of an owl. You know, so hearing is really just a vital sense, you know, for basically all beings. And when the noise pollution of roads, you know, all of those engines and air brakes and tires especially masks those auditory signals, you know, then animals don't want to live near the road, right? I mean, it makes a lot of intuitive sense. You know, so road noise is really driving creatures away from, you know, from vast swaths of habitat, I think. And, you know, and it affects humans in analogous ways. I mean, I think that in some ways noise pollution is one of the great unsung public health crises of our time. You know, there are lots of studies showing that noise pollution from roads is elevating our stress levels and cortisol levels and, you know, leading to cardiac disease and stroke and diabetes and truly shortening our lifespans, you know. So, I mean, certainly noise pollution is one of those things that we're so awash in every day that we, you know, in some ways cease to hear the noise pollution, and yet it's still, you know, doing really grievous damage to our lives and bodies.
So one thread that runs through the book is the idea or the study of road ecology. What is road ecology?
Yeah, it's a good question, you know, and it's in some ways it's difficult to define. I mean, you know, I think that the pithiest explanation is that it's the study of all of the many ways in which roads shape ecosystems and nature, and the wild animals who call those ecosystems home. I mean, it's, you know, it's called road ecology, but in some ways it's, you know, it's really, it might be more properly called transportation ecology, because there are road ecologists who are also working on things like trains and, you know, and marine roads, you know, the fact that there are these shipping lanes out there that, you know, the giant freighters, you know, use kind of habitually. So, you know, it's called road ecology, but, you know, there are certainly road ecologists working on other forms of transportation as well. And, you know, I think the reason that it's a difficult discipline to define is that, you know, is that roads are such a They're so transformative, you know, and they shape landscapes so profoundly that in some ways it's hard to figure out exactly where the purview of road ecology ends. You know, I mean, we've talked about things like roadkill and the barrier effect, right? These impacts on wildlife that are caused very immediately and directly by roads. But you know, roads are in some ways the necessary kind of precondition to all kinds of industrial activity and land use change and habitat loss. You know, one chapter of the book is about roads in Brazil, you know, and in the Amazon. You know, there's this what scientists know is this kind of fishbone pattern of roads where there's, you know, one big highway goes through the rainforest, and then all of these smaller roads, like the ribs of the fish, kind of extend up into the rainforest. And you know, that road network is obviously essential for deforestation and, you know, the conversion of rainforest to cattle pasture and, you know, and soybean plantations. So, you know, would you call deforestation a road ecology impact? You know, I mean, not exactly, and yet it's facilitated by the road, right? So, you know, in some ways, roads, I mean, the dumb little quip that I use in the book, you know, is that roads are the roots of all evil, you know, ROUTES. And you know, I think there's some truth to that they're kind of, again, the necessary infrastructure that precedes all habitat loss and land conversion.
And it is fascinating to me that roads have, I don't know, evolved the scientific discipline around them. How did road ecology develop as a field of study?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I mean, it's interesting. You can go back to the 1920s, and you know, there are road ecologists, even if you know they wouldn't have called themselves that. You know, there was this kind of fascinating explosion, you know, starting in 1925 or so, of biologists quantifying roadkill, which again was actually not even a term that existed at that point. You know, the word roadkill was not coined until the late 1940s. But you know, in the early 1900s, you know, cars were ascendant, obviously, and you know, biologists were really worried about cars' impacts on wildlife. You know, it was sort of this interesting parallel movement that was happening. You know, as cars took over American cities, you know, there was a lot of uproar about the dangers of automobiles. You know, there were no safety features back then. There was no signage. You know, you know, nobody really knew how to drive. Not that we're very good at it now. You know, so that, I mean, the death tolls in American cities due to cars were just catastrophic. And there was a lot of societal outrage about, you know, the incursion of the automobile into all of these, you know, pedestrian spaces. And, you know, in some ways, this kind of roadkill quantification science, you know, early road ecology began in the 1920s as this kind of analogous movement. You know, again, all of these biologists who were sort of like, wait a second, the car is this, you know, transformative, fearsome new technology. What is it doing to wild animals? You know, so there were all of these guys, you know, taking road trips around the country in the 20s and 30s, you know, counting the dead jackrabbits and garter snakes and red-headed woodpeckers that they found. So, you know, it goes back almost a century. The term road ecology, you know, kind of pops up in the 1990s. In English, it's coined by a guy named Richard Foreman, who is a landscape ecologist at Harvard. And you know, the story that he told me, that you know, I thought was really powerful, was that, you know, one day he was in his office with a bunch of students, and they were looking at this aerial photograph of the forest. And they were talking about, you know, all of the features of the forest. You know, here's where the water flows, and here's, you know, here are kind of the patches of animal habitat, and here's why the people, you know, put their houses where they did. And then suddenly, you know, Richard looked at the road running through the middle of the forest and said, wait a second, you know, we kind of know a lot about everything else in this picture, but we don't really know much about that, you know, about that road. And, you know, I think that kind of speaks to the fact that, you know, roads are such ubiquitous features of our lives, right? We use them every day. We drive on them all the time. You know, they're almost invisible to us. We take them for granted, you know, which I think is why they escaped study for as long as they did. So Richard was really the one who, you know, at least coined the English term, road ecology. And that was really when the field itself began, was in, you know, kind of in the mid 1990s.
Yeah. And sort of as part of that, it strikes me that maybe as features of the landscape, roads haven't been around as long as other things that animals have encountered. And so I guess in reading your book, it occurred to me that roads have a history, and that they have evolved through the years, some starting as wildlife trails. So how did we get from those sorts of, I don't know, less developed roads to the concrete and asphalt roadways that we have now?
Yeah, you know, it's this kind of interesting process of evolution. As you say, you know, a lot of some of our biggest highways began as animal paths. You know, often kind of carved by bison. You know, which migrated, of course, in these huge herds. You know, sometimes in search of salt licks and other resources. And you know, and then those animal trails became, you know, indigenous footpaths. You know, native people in North America had enormous networks of you know, I mean, this sort of blurs the line between trail and road, right? But, you know, certainly huge transportation networks all over the continent, you know, often kind of paralleling water courses, you know, and then those, you know, with the arrival of European colonists, you know, many of those native footpaths became wagon routes and then gravel roads. And, you know, and today some of them are interstate highways, you know, so it's kind of this, that's one of the many tragic ironies of roads, I think, is that, you know, these structures that began as animal infrastructure, in a sense, you know, became infrastructure that destroys wild animals. You know, it's kind of sad to think about. And too, you know, the fact that, I mean, so many of these native roads, or so many of these roads began as native trails and footpaths, and you know, were then subsequently, you know, in the 18th and 19th century, you know, commandeered by the U.S. Army and colonists and other sort of forces of you know, domineering that, you know, really ravaged native populations, right? So that's kind of the, yeah, again, the tragic irony of roads is that, you know, these structures began as you know, as trails created by wild animals and subsequently indigenous people, and then were used to subjugate indigenous people and destroy wild animals.
Right. So it's absolutely not an accident that roads now crisscross our country. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and you know, I mean, and you know, people like you know, John C. Calhoun, of course, you know, the famously racist senator, you know, were among the politicians pushing hardest for road networks in the 19th century because they recognized them as these, you know, potential tools of conquest. And you know, and certainly you see that not only in North America, but you know, but all over the world. You know, roads are this way of extending governmental and colonial power and industry, you know, and essentially conquering, you know, areas. And certainly that's the case in North America.
Yeah. So you mentioned when we were talking about road ecology that it's, you know, it's a fairly new discipline, at least in its name. And it strikes me that a lot of the studies in the space are newer, including those on migration. How have scientists documented the effects of roads on migration, and why was this so challenging to study?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, it's interesting. I mean the notion that animals migrate between different patches of habitat, you know, is something that certainly, you know, has been understood for a long time. And yet those migrations were very hard to follow. You know, one chapter of the book deals with sort of these migratory herds of mammals in Wyoming, you know, and of course, Wyoming's, you know, kind of a very rugged state. And, you know, these creatures are just, they're just hard to follow, you know, going back to the 1960s, you know, biologists would see these big herds of elk and mule deer and antelope, in valleys. And then those animals would just kind of go up into the mountains in summer, looking for kind of lush green high elevation pastures. And, and we just kind of lose them, and didn't really know, where they would go. So, it wasn't really until, the 1990s, that sort of tracking technology got sophisticated enough to follow these animals, first using, kind of radio telemetry sets. So, you'd put a collar on an elk, and then you'd fly around in a small airplane or, hike out there on foot trying to get the signal from that radio collar. And obviously that was, difficult and dangerous in its own right. And it, didn't tell you that much. It could tell you, if you detected that collar signal, in July, in one mountain range, and then you found it again in, in February in a valley, now you know two places that the animal uses, but you don't necessarily know how the animal moves between those places, right? So it really wasn't until the 2000s when satellite collars, sort of first became convenient and cheap, and they had long lasting batteries, and researchers were able to put these satellite collars on wild animals and then get all of these GPS points that not only told you where the animal spent the summer and where it spent the winter, but also told you how it got between point A and point B. What researchers we're able to do with that information is basically say, okay, we know where these migratory routes are, and now we know where they're crossing highways too. I mean, that's obviously really important information if you're going to build a wildlife crossing that allows animals to safely move over the highway. You have to know where those animals are moving. That's I think that you put your finger on the fact that, this is a kind of a newer discipline. Its rise has in some ways been fueled by technology, by the advent of these cheap, convenient, long-lasting satellite collars that have in relatively recent years been able to tell scientists exactly where these animals are moving across the landscape and intersecting with that human infrastructure.
I see. So you need to know where the animals are going in order to develop, make crossings for them. And so that, I guess, leads to the question of how did wildlife crossings originate? Where in the world was this idea coming from? And what were those early attempts to help animals cross roads looking like?
Yeah. Wildlife crossings really begin as European technologies, and really, I mean, to this day, a lot of European countries are the best at building them and have the most, especially the Netherlands is really, probably the world's leader in wildlife crossings and has more of them, per mile or per kilometer of road network than basically anybody. But, they really originate in France in the 1950s. It's basically these game bridges that were, sort of supposed to allow deer to cross roads in the French countryside, mostly at the kind of the behest of hunters who were worried about deer populations. And those early crossings weren't very effective. I think they were pretty narrow. They got used by farmers a lot. There's not much information out there about the efficacy of those early French wildlife overpasses, but pretty quickly that basic concept of a bridge for animals spreads to Germany, Austria, Switzerland, elsewhere in Europe, and those countries really take that idea and run with it, building increasingly large effective structures. In North America, it kind of lagged behind in a lot of ways. You go back to the mid 1970s, a few wildlife crossings, start to pop up here and there. There was an overpass in Utah for mule deer, and some underpasses in Wyoming and Colorado. But for the most part, it's really not until the late 80s, early 1990s that that wildlife crossings really start to become somewhat mainstream in the US. But it's interesting to sort of trace that evolution, because it's not you know, it's not linear, right? You would sort of think that, you know, okay, here's this useful technology that, you know, helps animals cross highways and avoids, you know, prevents collisions with, you know, with vehicles and deer. And, you know, obviously those collisions are potentially really dangerous. So it's like, it's a very intuitive idea, but, you know, it definitely is not this rapid exponential growth that you might expect. You know, it's almost like every single state has to kind of learn independently that, oh yeah, these things are effective and they work and we should be building more of them. You know, it's interesting to go back and talk to, you know, some of the engineers and biologists who built or consulted on you know, some of these early structures, and every single one of them, you know, has a story about having to, you know, convince a skeptical boss or superior that, you know, that these are actually a good idea. So yeah, it's you know, and you still see some skepticism today, but, you know, fortunately there is this huge body of scientific literature that points to the efficacy of these structures. So it's, you know, sort of a gradual evolution over time, beginning in Europe and then, you know, very gradually spreading through North America.
Yeah. And can you describe some of the wildlife crossings you've reported on? What do they look like? What sorts of needs do different animals have?
Yeah. You know, they're really, there's just a vast diversity of structures out there today. You know, the first wildlife crossings, or at least many of the first wildlife crossings, you know, are really aimed at those big herds of migrating deer and elk, you know, and that makes a lot of sense, right? Because those herds migrate along really predictable pathways, you know, and in some ways, you know, wildlife migration is almost this form of intergenerational culture, you know, where these migratory routes are passed down from, you know, doe to fawn or cow to calf, you know, over many, many generations. So, you know, so these animals, especially mule deer, you know, migrate in these really faithful ways. And as a result, they cross roads in really predictable places. And so, you know, it becomes possible, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s, you know, as this satellite collar technology is improving, to say, okay, every single year, you know, a big herd of mule deer is crossing the highway right here. And we can build, you know, an underpass, you know, which is often just a big kind of concrete box culvert, or, you know, a big sort of like dirt floored, you know, sort of tunnel, essentially, that allows those animals to cross under that highway safely. You know, and typically those underpasses are flanked by roadside fences, right? Because you don't want the animal crossing the highway anywhere it wants. You want to direct it to that safe crossing under the highway. So the fences are a really important part of the kind of the overall wildlife crossing system. You know, so that's really how it begins in many places like Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, Utah, you know, all of these Western states that have these big migratory herds of animals. You know, it really starts. Yeah, that's really how it starts. And then, you know, over time, it sort of spreads to different species as well. You know, now you're starting to see amphibian tunnels popping up. You know, in Amherst, Massachusetts, you know, the first salamander tunnel goes in the 1980s, and now, you know, there are a handful of these things kind of springing up. You know, and those sorts of tunnels, you know, they're a fraction the size of you know, a big tunnel for elk or mule deer. You know, and you could drive over them a million times and not realize there's a little passage for amphibians under the highway, but, you know, it's the same concept. It's just a you know, it's a safe passage under a roadway, you know, flanked by some kind of barrier that directs the animal to the passage. So, you know, and so I mean, now you see some version of this, you know, for so many different species all over the world, really. You know, I was recently in Texas looking at ocelot passages in southern Texas. You know, these little underpasses, you know, that have been used by ocelots and bobcats and other critters. You know, in Kenya there are, you know, giant underpasses, you know, two stories high for elephants. You know, in much of Central and South America, you know, you see rope bridges bridges going over highways for, you know, for primates that, you know, that have to cross roads without descending to the forest floor. So, you know, every species has its own slightly different set of requirements. And you know, that's a lot of what the road ecology movement has done is to figure out exactly what those different species need and, you know, try to tailor crossings to them.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And in your book, you mentioned that one of the big dilemmas in road ecology is that it's, one of the big questions in road ecology is, what does it even mean for a wildlife crossing to work? Do you mind speaking to that a bit?
Yeah, it's a great question, both, you know, that has both kind of a scientific and a philosophical answer. I mean, it's so on a very intuitive level, right? You'd imagine that a wildlife crossing works if animals used to cross the highway safely, right? And there's lots and lots of research showing that that happens. There are many studies basically saying that, you know, when you put a wildlife crossing in, with fences, you know, roadkill falls by around 90%. And, you know, these animal migrations are able to continue and animals learn to use the structures very quickly. So, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, of preventing these dangerous and expensive roadkill incidents and the standpoint of letting these movements continue, you know, we know that wildlife crossings are a good thing. The problem arises when you ask the question, okay, what does that mean for the larger animal population, right? If the goal of a wildlife crossing is to, you know, preserve a population of bears or elk or bobcats or what have you, you know, that's something we know a little bit less about. And, you know, one of the things that you see in, you know, some of these early road ecology studies is not all animals are using these crossings equally, right? There's a, you know, study from California basically showing that, you know, that bobcats and coyotes are crossing highways, but the animals who tend to cross are these sort of desperate young sort of subadults who are, you know, looking for their own territories, and they're not finding places to breed necessarily. They're moving back and forth across the highway, you know, looking for a mate and basically not finding them. So if what you care about is, you know, the population reproducing and, you know, the exchange of genetic material on either side of the highway, that's not really happening because, you know, the animals who are doing the crossing, you know, again, are these sort of like low status juveniles, you know, that aren't able to reproduce, you know, and you could sort of imagine that being the case, you know, in many different situations. And, you know, I mean, the problem with that is that, you know, we know that one of the big harms of roads is that they cause genetic fragmentation, right? And, it, you know, I mean, kind of the classic example of that are the mountain lions who live near Los Angeles in the Santa Monica Mountains. You know, those animals are so kind of hemmed in by freeways that they're unable to find mates outside of their own little population. And as a result, you know, some male mountain lions have ended up breeding with their daughters, granddaughters, great granddaughters, you know, and as a result, you know, the population is sort of increasingly inbred, and you know, genetic defects have started to crop up, and you know, and in the absence of a wildlife crossing, you know, that population would ultimately be doomed, right? So it's really important that animals not only cross highways, but you know, are able to breed on the other side to, you know, to kind of refresh the gene pool and you know, escape that kind of chronic inbreeding that's, you know, afflicted those mountain lions. But again, you know, if the only animals who are crossing are these, you know, kind of young, desperate subadults, and they're not mating on either side, you know, that's not happening. So, you know, that's something that road ecologists have become increasingly focused on is, you know, can we show not only that animals use these wildlife crossings, but that, you know, that males and females use them, that young animals use them, that you're getting the entire sort of diversity of a population, both demographically and genetically, and that they're, you know, that they're crossing the highway and successfully reproducing on either side of it. And that's not, you know, something you can necessarily show with a, you know, a motion activated camera trap, you know, at the mouth of the wildlife crossing. That's something that, you know, you really need to sort of create these, you know, you need a lot of genetic samples and to create these kind of sophisticated family trees. You know, and that's starting to happen, you know, in Banff National Park, where there, you know, there are some very famous wildlife crossings, you know, around 2016, 17, 18, you know, researchers did show that, you know, that grizzly bears were not only using these wildlife crossings, but that they were using them to reproduce on either side. And then they were taking their cubs back and forth across the crossings, and the cubs were learning to use them. So that's really important, right? That you get the entire, you know, the entire diversity of a population moving back and forth and reproducing.
I'm glad to hear that that work is underway, trying to figure out if the crossings are helping animals and their populations. And I'm glad that you mentioned the cougars living near LA. And it sounds like there's a campaign for those animals that may help future generations.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, that's a really, you know, an amazing story. I think it's one of my favorite stories in the book, because it just so clearly demonstrates, you know, the ways in which roads really distort nature and wildlife populations. And, you know, and I mean, there, as I said, there's this, you know, kind of a very small population of mountain lions, you know, trapped between the 101 and the 405. I mean, it's really some of the busiest freeways on planet Earth, you know, surround these animals, you know, which are just 30 miles or so from Los Angeles. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, research has basically shown that, you know, if those animals are not able to disperse out and find unrelated mates, you know, they are ultimately doomed. They're, you know, sort of trapped in what one paper called an extinction vortex, which I think is a really evocative term.
Yes.
You know, but fortunately, you know, as you say, you know, there is a wildlife crossing now being built for them. It's under construction. It's called the Wallace Annenberg Wildlife Crossing. It crosses the 101. Which I think is the busiest freeway in the United States, 10 lanes of traffic in both directions. You know, that's about 30 miles from Los Angeles. That should be done in 2025. And that's a really exciting project because, you know, it's in some ways the biggest and most ambitious project in the history of this discipline of road ecology. You know, it's this enormous freeway with, you know, hundreds of thousands of cars every day, you know, huge noise and light pollution problems that, you know, that the design of the wildlife crossing is kind of meant to mask. You know, the whole crossing itself covers about 9 acres. That's the kind of the bridge and the sort of surrounding habitat that they're engineering to, you know, sort of funnel the animals to the bridge. It's you know, sort of an incredibly exciting thing. And, you know, I mean, mountain lions are kind of the flagship that they're trying to get to cross. But, you know, the whole ecosystem is fragmented by this, you know, this giant freeway, right? So, you know, they're also thinking about, you know, creating habitat on this crossing for lizards and snakes and, you know, little birds like wren tits, you know, which are sort of birds that don't fly super well. So you need, you know, shrubs that, you know, allow them to kind of hopscotch across the top of this this overpass. You know, they're even, you know, they have a giant on-site nursery where they're, you know, they're growing the plants that are going to provide the vegetation and the habitat atop the crossing. You know, they've got, you know, sort of native fungi that they're going to use to inoculate the soil, you know, to create the kind of mycorrhizal networks, right? So it's this just unbelievably inspiring and ambitious project that's really attempting to not only build a bridge over the 101, but create an entirely new ecosystem that, you know, animals will not only cross over, but, you know, potentially live on top of.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. It will be really interesting to see how that plays out for the ecosystem there in the years to come.
It should be fascinating, you know. And they don't really, I mean, for to save that population of cougars, you know, they don't need a ton of animals moving back and forth across it. You know, even one animal crossing every 2 to 4 years, you know, could provide enough new genetic material to kind of refresh that gene pool and prevent extinction. So it'll be fascinating to see what happens.
So you mentioned amphibians and reptiles also having crossings built for them. What is happening to those animals at Rhodes?
Yeah, you know, I think in a lot of ways, you know, amphibians and reptiles are they're kind of the poster species for the harms of Rhodes. You know, and especially amphibians, you know, because they're, you know, in places like the Northeast, you know, in New England, you know, they undertake these big seasonal migrations, you know, to their breeding ponds. You know, they kind of spend the winter up in the upland forest, and then, you know, you get the first warm, wet spring night, and they all kind of move en masse to, you know, to breeding ponds to spawn. And the problem is that, you know, often roads run between those, you know, those two habitats, the forests and the wetlands. And, you know, and when, you know, a big army of spotted salamanders or leopard frogs or what have you, you know, goes walking across that road, you know, on a dark spring night when drivers don't necessarily see them, you know, the result can be carnage. And, you know, we're losing a lot of amphibian populations as a result of roads. So there are, you know, amphibian crossings out there. You know, I mentioned the spotted salamander tunnel in Massachusetts, but, you know, I think that for a long time, you know, we didn't really think much about amphibians in designing wildlife crossings, you know, and the reason for that is that, you know, a lot of early wildlife crossings were sort of aimed at these, you know, big migratory animals like deer and elk. And, you know, and partly that was because, you know, those big migratory herds cross the roads in predictable places. But it's also partly because obviously those are the animals that endanger driver safety, right? You know, something like, you know, 200 drivers are killed in deer crashes every year. And, you know, and large animal collisions, you know, cost society something like $8 billion every year in, you know, hospital bills and vehicle repairs and so on. So, you know, by building wildlife crossings that prevented collisions with deer and elk, you know, you could theoretically protect human safety. I mean, not theoretically, you can protect human safety and, you know, and save money as well. You know, and there's lots of research showing that, you know, wildlife crossings and some of these, you know, targeted at some of these migratory mammal herds, you know, actually pay for themselves very quickly because they just prevent all of these, you know, expensive collisions, which makes them very appealing to transportation departments, you know, which tend to be very cost conscious. Whereas, you know, nobody's really ever died hitting a salamander, right? So because these amphibians or reptiles, you know, were conservation concerns, but they weren't necessarily human safety concerns. You know, they transportation departments tended not to build crossings for them. And on occasion when, you know, transportation departments did try to allocate some money for, you know, a turtle tunnel or, you know, a salamander crossing or what have you, you know, politicians mocked them and called it government waste. I mean, who would want to spend $500,000 saving turtles? You know, what an outrageous idea. So yeah, that's another tragic irony of Rhodes is that, you know, some of the species that are most dire need of wildlife crossings, reptiles and amphibians, you know, have been some of the species that have most escaped our concern for a very long time. And, you know, and now thankfully that's, you know, starting to change to some extent.
Yeah. And so, and to that point that it's hard to get crossings built for amphibians, that led you to carrying frogs in a bucket across highways in Portland and seeing how people were trying to work for these animals in the absence of those means.
Yeah, that was a really fun experience. And, you know, I mean, and that, you know, there are many, many kind of amphibian bucket brigades out there, you know, and I mean, there, you know, this exists in, you know, everywhere from Canada to Belgium to, you know, South Africa, you know, where there are these citizen groups that are out there, you know, on these damp spring nights, you know, looking for amphibians that are, you know, trying to cross roads, you know, on their way to, you know, to their breeding ponds. And, you know, I was really fortunate, as you say, to participate in one of those efforts that would be the Harberton Frog Shuttle, which which is in Portland, Oregon, and there they have a population of northern red-legged frogs, a sort of an increasingly scarce, endangered frog species. This is actually the last population of red-legged frogs in Portland, and every year, they in the fall they go down from Forest Park, this big block of forest, to this wetland where they breed, and along the way they cross a couple of residential streets, they cross Highway 30, a big federal highway, a set of train tracks. So there's so much infrastructure, between their two habitats, and definitely some mass flattenings were had been observed in the past. And a few years ago, or a number of years ago now, this group of residents, who had kind of documented this problem, got together and they started this wonderful little frog shuttle, where they drive around, picking up frogs and moving them to the breeding pond. And then when I came, it was spring, so they basically they kind of spent the winter in this breeding pond, and now the frogs were ready to migrate back to the forest. So we just it was a really fun, beautiful experience. Basically, this group sets up a little temporary fence along the edge of the wetland. The frogs all hop out, on their way to the forest, and then they bump into this fence, and they're not the smartest animals in the world. They just kind of sit there, and we just walked up and down the fence, picking up these frogs and putting them in buckets. And then when we had a bunch of them, driving them up to the forest, so they could make it back to their habitat without having to brave traffic that would surely kill them. So it was a beautiful thing, and it was really touching and inspiring to see dozens of people out on a cold, rainy night, saving these creatures that are not exactly warm and cuddly. It was a really beautiful thing. But it's also an imperfect thing. I mean, I think that even the the organizers of that effort would say, this is a temporary, imperfect measure. Obviously we don't get every single frog, some still get killed. They'd be better off if they had some kind of wildlife crossing structure that, allowed them to make this journey without human help. The problem is there's just so much infrastructure that you would need a very long, dark tunnel, which might not be super appealing to the frog. So it's a difficult situation to mitigate, that's another interesting dilemma. We'll see what happens long term there. There have been proposals for a wildlife crossing there, but it would also be the biggest and most expensive amphibian tunnel ever constructed, and it's not clear that funding exists, or that it's even feasible. So those kinds of amphibian bucket brigades, again, they're these beautiful, inspiring situations that are also kind of necessarily imperfect.
Another part of your book that I found very heartwarming was your reporting from visiting Tasmania, the roadkill capital of the world, and talking about the people who pick up animals who have been hit on the road. Can you tell us about those carers?
Yeah, I'm so glad that was a chapter that spoke to you, because that was one of my favorite experiences working on this book. So Tasmania, I went to Tasmania, which has actually the highest documented roadkill rate in the world, or certainly one of the highest. It's just an island with really abundant, profuse wildlife. There are wallabies and wombats and catamelons, which are basically tiny kangaroos, and there are all of these kind of rural sinuous highways through the bush. So it's kind of this very volatile combination of abundant animals and sort of dangerous road conditions, and so as a result a lot of animals are killed. But kind of the fascinating unique thing about about Tasmania is that, you know, of course it's part of Australia, so it has marsupials, right? All of, you know, basically all of the animals are marsupials, and as a result, you know, of course female marsupials carry their joeys, their offspring, in a pouch, and you know what often happens, very tragically, is that the mother is killed by a car, but the joey, the baby, actually survives in the pouch. You know, because the, I mean, especially like an animal like a wombat is this big, robust animal, you know, whose body basically acts as a buffer, you know, when she's hit by a car. So there, you know, there's this incredible sort of army of, you know, of carers, which is basically, you know, the Australian term for wildlife rehabilitators, who drive around Tasmania checking the pouches of dead female marsupials, wombats and wallabies and pademelons and possums, and then extracting the still living joeys within. It's just fascinating and, you know, a little bit gruesome, because, you know, often what they do is they check the pouch of a dead animal, and then to indicate that they've checked the animal's pouch, and so nobody else has to do it, they'll just spray paint, you know, a line or an X across that animal. So, you know, you drive around and you see all of these dead spray painted animals. It's kind of bizarre and macabre.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it's really strange, and you know, so then when they find, you know, these orphaned joeys, these babies, you know, they then take them home and they raise them, and you know, in some cases, you know, I mean, a baby wombat can take 2 years to raise to adulthood, and that's 2 years of, you know, basically constant bottle feeding and, you know, and giving medicine and, you know, wiping their butts and, you know, keeping them warm and cared for. And, you know, and some of these carers who I met, you know, will have dozens of animals. I mean, it really becomes this incredible full-time job that they, you know, spend all of their savings on. That's, again, just, you know, a remarkably, yeah, as you say, heartwarming, inspiring situation to, you know, to see this island with such an incredible culture of concern for wild animals. But, you know, it's also just like the frog thing, you know, it's also a little bit troubling in some ways, you know, in that, I mean, here is this island that has, you know, some of the highest roadkill rates in the world, and yet, you know, there are basically no wildlife crossings. You know, there haven't really been infrastructural solutions put forth on Tasmania, you know, and as a result, these wildlife rehabilitators bear this, you know, enormous kind of societal burden, you know, when in some ways, you know, it's probably the responsibility of the government to be, you know, trying to solve this problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And tragically, as you mentioned, it's not entirely clear that these rehabilitated animals or that rehabilitating animals and releasing them back to this dangerous environment is helping these populations.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, that was definitely a, you know, one point that, you know, one carer, a guy named Bruce Englefield, who's, you know, sort of both a carer and studies the practice of caring, pointed out to me, is that, you know, they're right, that, you know, all of these carers are raising these animals to adulthood, and then they're releasing them into the exact same, you know, dangerous situation that, you know, made them orphans in the first place. And, you know, it's not clear that, you know, that how, it's not, I mean, no, really nobody knows what percentage of these animals survive, because they're not really tracked. And, you know, whether caring actually contributes to the, you know, the survival or the growth of wildlife populations. It's you know, it's kind of a challenging situation. And, you know, I think that there's, I mean, one of the things that fascinated me working on this book is that there's, you know, there's this interesting divide, I think, in some ways, between wildlife rehabilitators and, you know, professional road ecologists and wildlife biologists and conservation biologists, you know, and the conservation biologists and the road ecologists, you know, I mean, their focus tends to be rare species, you know, species that might, you know, really decline or even go extinct, you know, without human intervention. Whereas, you know, the wildlife rehabilitators, you know, basically take the perspective that, you know, that every life is kind of precious, even if it's, you know, a member of a common species. And, you know, as a result, I think there's not a lot of cross-pollination between those two communities. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're both concerned about the same problem, which is the road.
Right. Yeah. And in your book that you mentioned that there are some efforts that are trying to bridge those two populations. What are some of the ways you found that the general public is getting involved with road ecology?
Yeah. It's in some really exciting and fun ways. You know, I mean, road ecology is really a field that's ripe for participatory science or volunteer science or citizen science, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's really kind of a perfect field for the participation of the general public. And, you know, and the reason for that, of course, is that, you know, we're all driving around out there, you know, and we're all, you know, we're all sort of members and participants and contributors to the road network. You know, it also doesn't take any, you know, it doesn't take a huge amount of expertise to, you know, identify a, you know, a dead skunk or a raccoon. So as a result, you know, there are all of these sort of recent-ish citizen science efforts, you know, mostly using smartphone apps that ask volunteers and you know, and everyday citizens to, you know, basically log the roadkill that they see while they're driving around. And, you know, in some cases, that data has been really valuable in, you know, first, you know, telling us stuff about wildlife populations, right? I mean, roadkill is this, you know, kind of inadvertent sort of form of animal population sampling that tells you, you know, how many critters are out there and where they're distributed. And, you know, if there are, you know, invasive species entering an ecosystem, you know, it's just valuable sort of scientific data. And, you know, it's also valuable data when it comes to identifying locations for wildlife crossings, right? I mean, all of that, you know, all of that citizen science can tell you, you know, where the roadkill hotspots are that, you know, the transportation agencies need to deal with. So yeah, there are lots of great citizen science projects out there. I got to take part in one of them in Montana, where basically spent a day, you know, riding 50 miles on a bicycle, surveying roadkill, you know, along the side of a busy highway. And it was, you know, it was really eye-opening. I mean, I think that one of the, you know, the interesting things about roadkill is that, you know, when you're driving along in a car on a highway at 70 miles an hour, you know, you're so insulated from the world that you don't really notice most roadkill. You know, yes, you see the big messy deer carcasses, but, you know, you're kind of sealed in your little bubble. And, you know, you don't really see the smaller critters. And it was just, you know, really remarkable being out there on a bicycle where you're, you know, you're rolling along at 12 miles an hour and you're much closer to the ground to see, oh man, there are so many songbirds by the side of the road. And, you know, and I mean, we saw magpies and ravens and red-tailed hawks. You know, there's really a large bird community, especially that's being hit, that, you know, that you just don't detect, you know, when you're cruising along at 70 miles an hour. So I think that's, you know, that's part of the power of sort of participatory or citizen-led roadkill science too, is that, you know, is that it gets you out of your car in some cases and you know, allows you to kind of see these trends and patterns that, you know, wouldn't be necessarily visible, you know, if we were just trapped in our cars.
Yeah, definitely. And so we've talked a lot about some of the problems that roads create for wildlife and ecosystems. But you also share in your book about how emerging nations are leading the charge in designing roads with wildlife in mind. Do you mind saying a bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think it's funny to, you know, sort of go back to when I started working on this book proposal, you know, 5 years ago. I think I had a very wrong idea of you know, sort of global road ecology, and that, you know, what I imagined was that, you know, we've built all of these great wildlife crossings in North America and Europe, and, you know, surely all of these other countries, you know, like India and Brazil and you know, Nepal, that are, you know, that whose own road networks are being built out now, you know, surely they're going to learn from, you know, all of the cool projects here in the Western world. And, you know, and that's not really the case. I mean, I think that, you know, like there are just some incredible examples of, you know, innovation in the developing world that we should be learning from. You know, I mean, when I went to Brazil to report this book, you know, I went to one of the places I visited was a state park that, you know, had a busy highway through it. And, you know, Brazil had actually kind of rebuilt the highway so that it was really sinuous and wavy and had no shoulders. I mean, basically, they had taken this, you know, this fast moving straight highway, and they had remade it in a way that was essentially impossible to drive fast on, you know, which is just kind of this incredible radical solution that, you know, we really haven't tried, you know, in North America. I mean, imagine taking, you know, I-70 or I-80 and, you know, and deliberately making it curvy. You know, that's just sort of impossible to imagine. But, you know, they had done that in Brazil for the sake of wildlife. You know, I mean, another example that, you know, I didn't visit in person, but, you know, I've certainly read a lot about and talked to people about, you know, is this stretch of new highway in India, you know, where they, you know, the Indian government was building this highway through a tiger sanctuary. And, you know, instead of having a surface level highway with a few wildlife crossings, they actually elevated the entire highway on these giant concrete pilings so that the, you know, the highway went over the land and the animals could, you know, could sort of navigate the, you know, the land underneath the highway uninterrupted. So, you know, in that sense, it, you know, it's almost like the, yeah, it's you know, it's just lifting the entire footprint of the highway out of the habitat zone, you know, which again is just much more radical than, you know, than anything that has really happened in North America. So, you know, I find that sort of thing incredibly inspiring. You know, there are these countries that are building out their transportation networks now, and because they don't have, you know, 60-year-old highways that are kind of set in stone, they're able to do some, you know, some really innovative, progressive, radical things.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear about those examples. So I would like to end maybe on a more philosophical note, as there is a philosophical thread running through this book, considering what roads mean for people. What do you mean when you say a road is never just a road? What do roads symbolize to societies?
Yeah, that is a good question, Carolyn, and really a broad one. And, you know, I mean, they symbol so many different things, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of amazing to, you know, think about all of the music and literature in which roads symbolize freedom and human mobility. You know, I mean, from, you know, Jack Kerouac to, you know, to Bruce Springsteen to Prince, you know, roads are sort of this, kind of the ultimate avatars of our own movement. It's, you know, the roads are how we escape our, you know, our humdrum childhoods and go west and explore, you know, and that's, I mean, again, you know, one of the great ironies of roads is that they contribute to human mobility, even as they curtail and truncate animal mobility, you know, but there are all kinds of other ways in which roads are symbols. You know, one chapter of this book is about the history of the U.S. Forest Service, which, you know, unbeknownst to most people, I think, operates the largest road network in the world, almost 400,000 miles. And, you know, a lot of those roads are old logging roads or firefighting roads, you know, that have been kind of repurposed by recreation enthusiasts, you know, of which I am one, you know, people who use those roads to access nature, and, you know, and to explore the wilds, and, you know, and I mean, kind of, again, the, I'm going to keep saying irony, but I feel like there are so many ironies in road ecology, but, you know, the irony of, you know, all of those forest roads is that, you know, they are how we experience nature. And, you know, I use them all the time to get to trailheads and fishing holes and, you know, and campsites and so on, even as they're destroying nature, right? I mean, you know, all of those forest roads, you know, they erode sediment into streams and, you know, and destroy trout and salmon spawning habitat. You know, they allow poachers to kind of get into the backcountry. They become, you know, the point which wildfires start, right? I mean, you know, we know that those forest roads have really profound ecological impact. So, you know, that's again, the kind of the tension of roads, I think, is that they, you know, they are Yeah, they're both entry points into nature and disruptors and destroyers of nature. But because they because they're so well used by people, they've become these symbols, I think, of human entry and access, and even though the Forest Service is, often tries to close or even destroy those old harmful roads, there's always a lot of uproar about that idea because, those roads are, that they kind of symbolize in some ways, our ability to use nature and our dominion over nature as well. So they do carry a lot of symbolic weight. They're sort of the ultimate manifestation of this idea we have that the planet is ours for the using and taking, and any attempt to pull back on that access is becomes this kind of political or cultural flashpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and your book emphasizes a lot that we all use roads, or most of us use roads, and that's why we should care about crossings and how they affect the natural world.
Yeah, I think so. One thing I was conscious of is just it's hard because on one level all of the research that that I looked at and conducted tells you, of course, that driving is one of the most harmful things we can do to the natural world, right? And yet it's so inescapable. I have a car and I use that car, and I've hit wild animals and so on, right? I think that to me, it's shaming individual drivers for driving. That just doesn't get you anywhere, because we've set up this society that demands driving. It's sort of like climate change, right? Where we've figured out that we're not going to solve climate change by changing our light bulbs. We need political and infrastructural and social systems that that decarbonize our planet. I think that road ecology tells us the same thing. If the goal is to, shame individual drivers, that gets us nowhere. If the goal is to rebuild infrastructure that's less harmful to the planet, that's kind of the task that's before us.
Thank you again for talking with me, Ben.
Thank you, Carolyn, for your great questions. I really appreciate it.
If you'd like to learn more about Ben Goldfarb and his book, Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet, we've linked to his website at scienceforthepeople.ca. On our page, you'll also find links to our show on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe, or leave a review. Thanks for listening to Science for the People.
Science for the People is listener-supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Bethany Brookshire and Rochelle Saunders, and is edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Carolyn Wilkie, and me, Rochelle Saunders.